Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast. This week it was me, Phil Brining, and Laura Brendel in the hot seat. So we were talking about the Freedom of Information Act. Thank you for giving it your time, Laura. What did you make of it? You haven't been on the podcast for a while, have you?
No, I came on a couple of weeks ago, just not intended, just jumped in because we were talking about SARS. But I thought it went really well. I loved everyone's FOIA.
Oh, there was tons weird and wonderful on the FOIAs. Chat. Yeah. There was tons going on. I couldn't keep pace with how much was on the chat. There was lots of engagement. We had a lot of people unmuting and sharing, you know, their stories and asking questions and putting fantastic points of view forward. So it was a really good session. And what was really pleasing was it comes on the back of us winning the award for the European Cybersecurity Bloggers Award for the best podcast.
I know, which was amazing. And I think to have such an engaging session straight after that was really good. Yeah, and to display the award on the podcast as well, I think was when you finally got it in shot.
Yeah, the one that nearly left in my hotel room.
yeah, that one.
Got to be in shot for that one. So. But I mean, we did cover a bit of the news in with some interesting stuff happened this week in the news. But the main event was really talking about FOIA. And I thought that we would easily cover FOIA. And we have absolutely just not even scratched the surface.
Yeah,
we've talked about around FOIA, haven't we?
Yeah, that was an intro session and / therapy session, I think, for people.
Therapy session is good, but I think we should have another few sessions about FOIA. We should possibly just plug it in the calendar as a regular thing, because there's obviously a lot of interest in it. You know, there's over 100 people on the session live, which is a good turnout, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And FOIA is one of those things, anyone who deals with it gets that like nervous twitch whenever you mention the term FOIA, they sort of start to do that. So I think it's good for them to have a release and get in touch with each other and talk about all the different things that they've done. I think it'd be good to do a session on exclusions as well, and where people have applied them and how they've used it, so that other people can start to use that. Like commercially sensitive information, vexatious as well.
We had a good chat about vexatious, didn't we, and the concept of vexatious. That was good. I think my favourite part of it was just people coming forward with these absolutely wacky requests.
Completely, yeah. Exorcisms, ghosts in hospitals.
Dog excrement, awesome. How many items have been picked up each year? Bike stands, taps, how many taps do you have?
Do you have any boars in your back garden?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I mean, that is just colourful, isn't it? But I mean, it begs the question, which we did scratch the surface of a little bit, you know, it's beneficial. It's highlighted some wrongdoing in Parliament, you know, the Freedom of Information Act. But I mean, some of the requests are frivolous. Is it too broad? You know, should it be restricted to UK citizens, information about UK? You know, it just has that debate been had sufficiently? I don't know, really.
It definitely needs a revisit. I think all our legislation periodically needs a revisit, because society moves on so much and the way things are used move on so much. I think it's just one of those bits of legislation that's just got left behind a little bit. And I think what they intended it to be isn't exactly what it's used for. So I think under that spotlight, it could do with a review.
And that's why I'm surprised that there was such pressure to do the DPDI and review the GDPR, which I think, and a lot of people think, works and hasn't been in place long enough to say doesn't work. But FOIA, does it do what it intended to do? Is it too broad? Could it be fine-tuned? Could it be improved? Mm-hmm. It's been in place for 24 years, implemented for 19 years. Surely it's time for review, but it's not on the agenda, doesn't appear to be on the agenda.
No, and I don't think it will be for a while. It's not got really any political sway to buy them any favour in one way or the other.
Yeah. Although Lawrence made a fantastic point that, you know, the political parties benefit from it and therefore may not want to repeal it. Repeal it, to amend it.
Two reasons. One, they can get access to information they wouldn't necessarily see. Yeah. The other is they can just annoy each other. So it's just time wasting from one side to the other.
Yeah. Fantastic. And that's the great beauty of the Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah.
Now, we briefly touched also on a side legislation, the Environmental Information Regulations, but I don't know if we've ever done a session on the EIR. Maybe we should have a look at that.
Yeah, we can do one of those as well. Yeah.
Right. Well, anyway, listen, thank you very much for your time in joining us, Laura. I know you're extremely busy running both the SAR Bureau and the support desk, so much appreciate you putting the time. But your background in public authority has been really useful to kind of bring this session to life. So thank you.
It was nice and cathartic.
And you definitely resonated with the listeners. You know, what you were saying, you know, it was driving the chat, I think. So well done for that. Thank you. And without any further ado, we'll leave you to listen to the main session.
Yeah. Enjoy, everyone.
find out that there's no structure to it, which I think is what people seem to like about it. But anyway, welcome to this week. Now, this week we're meant to be talking about the Freedom of Information Act. And Laura, I know you've had some good experience working in public authorities, and therefore we can talk at length about elements of that. And if anybody's got any questions or comments or observations or their own points of view to put in, you know, please do chip in, because it's your session. You know, it's not us. We're just kind of leading some of the conversation, I guess, really. But in the news, we always start off these sessions with a bit of news. And for those that don't know Laura, I really appreciate you coming on, Laura. I know you're extremely busy because you run both the SAR Bureau and the support team. So you have, it's like herding cats probably all the time for you, is it?
And a bit of consultancy thrown in just for fun.
And a bit of consultancy for good measure, yeah. So thank you very much for putting the time in, you know, giving your time up for joining me today here. Joe and Jazz are out doing other things today, so that they're missing in action. But I believe he'll be back next week. But you'll see we've got a new backdrop, just especially for today. So if you remember that we were nominated for the European Cybersecurity Blogger Awards of Best Podcast. And I went down to London on Wednesday and Thursday, and was asked to attend some events, which was a funny story, Laura, because I couldn't find the blooming place where it was. It was at Excel, and this thing was in the Tapa Tapa, a restaurant. And I went at every single restaurant on the main drag, just outside the Excel, asking, you know, is this Tapa Tapa, and showing my pass and saying, is this where these awards are? And everyone saying, no, it's down the road. And I got to the very end of the warehouse, this old warehouses, and it wasn't there. So I thought, well, you know, I'm going to just go home if I can't find these awards. So I asked another bouncer, and he said, oh, it's actually upstairs. You've got to go back into the Excel, down the road, and in across the footbridge. So I did do that, and I got there a little bit early, and I got in, and I said to one of the organizers, what is this anyway? He said, it's European Cyber Security Bloggers Award. I said, oh, all right, okay. What's the format? I said, well, you know, you've been nominated for an award, have you? I said, oh, have we? So I felt a right chump, I can tell you. And I'd been wound up all during the course of that by James Naylor, who insisted it was going to be a black tie event, and I was there in my jeans and a shirt because I'd been attending the InfoSec exhibition. So it all started off on a bad footing, really. And then I nearly left the award in my hotel room. I was just checking out my hotel room yesterday morning, and I looked round. Door was just closing. I thought, oh, blimey, that's the award. This is the award. I don't know if you can see. And from the side, it looked like one of those menus you get in hotels. So I thought it was part of the hotel fixtures and fittings. So it nearly got lost in transit as well. But yeah, so we were nominated, and we were voted, and we won. And I think that's down to everyone here, you know, the listeners and the community voting for us. So, you know, but thank you for voting for the podcast. But you know, if you just move your shoulder to the side, this is, you know, it's not our podcast we're just hosting. Yeah. It's the community's podcast. It's the community's award. So, you know, well done, Data Protection Community, for winning this award. Brilliant.
We'll have to get ourselves a little trophy cabinet and start to collect.
Yeah, it'll be a bit low.
We'll send you a map though next time.
Yeah,
and let you know what you're going to.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the big news of the week, apart from, of course, the hospital breach that's a critical incident, so on and so forth. What have you been up to this week then yourself? Or I've been down to London for 2 days, which is really good. What have you been up to?
I've been doing a mixture of SARs. We've had some complex SARs in, some of our standard SARs, a little bit of FOIA across some schools, which has been quite exciting. I always find FOIA and SARs linked together. It's always people that like to put both in at the same time, particularly.
We've got a lot of that. We must have, what, 350 school customers?
Yeah.
We've got a lot of school customers, haven't
lots
we?
Lots of schools. So it's been a busy week, and everyone's obviously wrapping up, ready for term time to finish. So we're getting all the requests in a sort of pipelined panic.
Because, of course, the clock doesn't stop, does it, during the holidays?
And it's that period where everyone asks for all the technique around all the exams. So you have to know what you can release and what you can't, and what's commercially sensitive and everything else, depending on who's doing the exam marking.
Yeah.
So it's been very exciting.
You've had a busy week. I'll tell you what struck me at InfoSec. There's three things really that struck me. One was there's a lot of software now, which we need to investigate. So I've gone on a bit of a mission to investigate this. I did go around every single stand, which I was absolutely worn out by the end of the day, which is partly why I thought, do I have to go to these blogger awards? But the thing that struck me is lots of people selling supply chain management software applications.
Okay.
Now, they don't quite go, they're all focused on cybersecurity, you probably would expect. Now, they don't quite go as far as we would want something to go. And actually, we were looking at building something in Datawise ourselves to do supply chain management. So what they're doing is they're kind of checking the, building a database, checking the security credentials of processes, effectively platforms that you might use. So it's not fully comprehensive. It can be used to send out questionnaires, track whether they're coming back in, all that type of stuff. But it doesn't do what we would want it to do is check, you know, terms of process agreements, yeah, privacy policies, all that type of stuff. Thank you very much. But that was quite interesting because a few years ago there was none of that around, and there were probably 15 companies sort of selling those types of systems. The whole show was very much about outsourced security, and you know, every time you read a breach, it's about outsourced services, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But what really worried me was biometrics. Lots of biometric companies there, and their go-to use case is access control, which, and I said to one of the Japanese company called Tunnel Biometric Security, I said, you know that the ICO has banned that in the UK, Serco, and they are, they have no idea. But what worries me is, go in there as an IT cyber person, you think, oh, that's a great idea, we'll get that, it's biometrics, it's retinal scans, it's vein scanning, it's fingerprint scanning. They've even got plastic cards where you scan, so more like a token.
Oh.
That's the latest application, and I'm just worried that the IT guys are going to be saying this, let's get this, without really thinking about the implications, particularly UK, where the ICOs are taking a stance on it. So that was they're my take to InfoSec, basically.
Wow.
Well, what's been in the news then? The news, proper news, rather than our news.
I mean, my news was boring compared to your news. It was I think yours was quite interesting. You've got crooks threatening to leak personal records stolen from background check firms. You've got all sorts of exciting stuff.
Though, nearly 3 billion records.
I know. Yeah, that's not a small number, is it?
No, but I mean the common thread on that. I read about the Welsh Rugby Members Club's data breach as well. Like 80,000 members of Welsh Rugby getting leaked. The common denominator is third parties.
Yeah.
It's supply chain, and that's the worrying thing, isn't it? And that's the thing about this vendor risk management is, how it's really quite hard to do. We do it manually. That's why we're looking for better tools to do it. And that, ultimately could involve and does involve sometimes a site visit, looking at a data center. Esther and I did an audit the other week of a company, and we were asking they said, you need to drill into our supplier, asking their supplier, where's the data? It's in the data center, colo data center. Well, what does that mean? It means that we've got a rack in somebody else's data center, so they manage all the external security. Right, anyway, is the data anywhere else? Yeah, it's in an overflow data center. Where's that? It's in a different building. Yeah, whereabouts? In Stockholm. Yeah, where in our offices? All right, okay, so is that a data center? I don't know, it's just an office block with a server in it. All right, well, is that the weakest point then? unless you ask the questions and go and say, I said to the client, have you been out there to see this stuff? No, right, okay. it's tricky, isn't it, when we're relying on third parties?
Yeah, it is. You have to rely a lot of the time, particularly when you're just doing basic due diligence. You've got to rely on the information they give you being accurate. And they don't necessarily give you as much detail as you would probably need to do with thorough analysis before going into that contract.
Yeah. So my oldest daughter alerted me to the Santander breach, because Business Bank is Santander, but it didn't affect UK accounts. But this backgrounds check firm does. It's US, British and Canadian citizens. But I mean, background check information is going to be quite sensitive, potentially, quite detailed, involved family members and all sorts of things. So, potentially quite worrying. The other thing that I saw, and I want to do a feature in a few weeks' time on much more on biometrics, but there's again the facial recognition technology is getting raised again in the news, isn't it? So I noticed a couple of stories. One was somebody accused of shoplifting and then thrown out of Home Bargains. They just walked in and then somebody came up and said, "You're a shoplifter, you're bound to get out," you know, and it was a wrong person. And then so you kind of on a bit of a downer thinking, you know, this is intrusive, it's that, you know, blah blah blah. And then you read that the Met use it, and they've arrested 92 people so far this year through using facial recognition technology, which is, you know, pretty good going. What, 6 months, isn't it? They've also had instances of arresting the wrong person and detaining people for 20 minutes whilst they've been incorrectly identified. But, you know, their view, which you have to have some sympathy for, is that it's actually taking dangerous people off the streets, or it's help making people accountable for actions if they're skipping parole and things. So, yeah, you know, it's just that head to head, you know, there's some tension there, isn't there, about, you know, that the police's application has probably got some merit, but using it in shops, you know, has that got as much merit?
To be fair, so they're not known for their getting the right people without facial recognition. So
who are the shops or the police?
Police.
Moving on. So that was it. And I want to I think we're because the ICA has produced some information about biometrics. There's been quite a few news stories about biometrics. And I think I really want to have a deeper look at it.
Proper look underneath it. Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah. To you know, just kick a debate around about it. And the critical incident declared in the hospitals was interesting as well, because I mean the first thing I noticed was, you know, the critical incident, that sounds to me like a network and information systems regulations terminology, therefore, you know, they're an NHS Foundation Trust, therefore they are caught by the NHS, by the NIS regulations, you know, in the St Thomas's Hospital, etc. And so it sounded like, you know, the systems were ground to a halt because of a cybersecurity attack, and it was highlighted as being a critical incident under the NIS regulations. I think it wasn't explicit in the news stories I read about it, but that was my first reaction, was it's a critical incident under that. So that was interesting. And that's going to roll out, isn't it, over the next couple of weeks, I guess, how that's occurred.
Yeah.
One of these I read about was the exfiltration of data. Was that the Ticketmaster hack, or was that the, I can't remember, I have to read my notes again. Or was it the criminal record checks?
The Ticketmaster notorious hacker group, that one.
Yeah, no, that wasn't exfiltration, was it? Well, one of them I read about was, again, insider threat exfiltration of data. I saw a very interesting stand in him for a second, and it said start from a position of zero trust. And I thought, well, why don't we start from a position of zero trust? We tend to start from a position of, well, you know, this company down the road uses this supplier, or this, you know, other person in our industry uses this supplier, therefore we trust them. But we should flip it on its head and think, you know, you've got to demonstrate why we should trust you and your systems and things. Yeah. But and that was quite resonated with me, that, you know, start from position zero trust. And, you know, the exfiltration of data is internal people, you know, nicking the data, into flogging it.
Yeah, we've had some interesting cases on that quite recently with in some, I won't specify sectors, in some sectors where data has been taken from a particular organisation by people that are disgruntled and have left, and it's been used in different environments and been taken by them without the control necessarily of the original data controller.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things that happens, I'm afraid. I mean, I read something a few months ago now saying that there was a worrying trend in cybersecurity professionals being susceptible to bribes and for exfiltration of data. That was in one of the reports I read. Anyway, and then the final thing I noticed was Google are starting to permanently delete their users' location history unless people actually opt in for doing that, which sounded like a good thing to me. And I was a bit surprised. Shouldn't be surprised. I was in the Coniston last week, which I was on the podcast, and on the way over stopped like a van, you know, camper van showroom. Next thing I know, I stopped at a camper van showroom, right? Next thing I know, every single advert on my Google, you know, news thread is for camper vans. So, you know, so that sounds looks to me like that location data is being used, right? This person's interested in camper vans.
Yeah.
Not because I've Googled it or searched it, but because I actually stopped at a van showroom. And now I'm being targeted for van adverts.
How long till you buy one?
Well, I won't buy one from Avantium because about 100 grand. Absolutely ridiculously expensive. If I was going to buy one, I'll go around to a local builder. He's got a 2004 Ford Transit. I'll give him 50 quid for it and I'll fit it out myself. You know what I'm like. That's why I'm wearing free T-shirts. Right. Anyway, moving on.
Before we move on, I think people want to see the award again. So do you want to redisplay?
Right. Okay. I will redisplay. I mean, the backdrop that we made, it's very hard kind to of get a, it into
it's
the
It's merging in, isn't it? Yeah. There we go.
I just have to, if I move out the picture, maybe, I don't know.
Bit, yeah.
I can't see it. We'll have to
put a picture up and
take a picture of it. Yeah, it's not very good with this funny backdrop on, but it's good. And I think what the judges said making the award was that it what was nice about from their view of the podcast, it wasn't commercial, it wasn't flogging anything, it wasn't Well, they said, they didn't use the word boring, but they made that implication. It might well be boring, but it wasn't too structured. You know, it was fluid. And they said that that seemed to be giving something back to the community, which is exactly why we're doing it, is trying to gel the community and give a forum for what is sometimes a lonely role. So that's what they said in the thing, which was really quite good, actually.
Yeah, we essentially just allow you guys an insight into our general conversations in day-to-day life, and you just get a chance to input and feel part of the team.
Exactly. And of course the listeners know more about some things than we do, and are just as experienced as we are, and they've got absolutely every opportunity to reach the same conclusions, make the same points, which is good. That's why it's a community. Anyway, freedom of information is our main topic for today. So just give me your, I can't remember your background, Laura, but you spent quite a while in public authorities, haven't you? So you must have been familiar with it, but you're only a young whippersnapper, so you can't have been working there when this act was introduced.
Thank you. No, I wasn't quite.
You were in school still, weren't you?
I was. just. Well, education. But yeah, no, I actually started my data protection and information governance journey through FOIA. So I worked for a little local district council. My inception to it was a nice fit for the future programme. And we essentially had a publication scheme, and we had a couple of people that coordinated all the FOIA requests to different teams. And what we're going to touch on is sort of publication and the drive to publish more to mitigate resource. And that's essentially what I started out doing. So I realised that we had about 26-30 requests every single month that went to the same teams, and the same responses went out every single month. So my journey was to update the publication scheme, do a FAQ page, and get ahead of some of the governance issues that created public issues. So big cabinet papers that were controversial, essentially, and making sure we had some FAQs around that and the general FAQs. So that's kind of how I started, and then data protection grew into that.
Mm. Right. What's your? I mean, my passion is the data protection rather than the FOIA stuff. But what have you got any preferences to what you prefer? Data protection, freedom of information. Where which area do you like working in the most, or have you not got a preference?
I don't really have one. I've always loved law of every form. I've loved the intricacies, all the additions. So yeah, all of it for me. I love all of it.
Right. Very good. Yeah. Said this, I think it was one of our quiz questions when we did a quiz 1 year about the Tony Blair's quote from his biography.
Yes.
you want to run through it? I mean, I'm sure everyone's aware of it, but yeah.
Does anyone actually, before we navigate into Tony Blair, just if anyone who doesn't know on this call what FOIA is, if any of you aren't caught by it, because I'm conscious some of you might not be. So FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act, so it essentially opens all public bodies, just in a nice nutshell, to being subject to any request for information. And on the face of it, you then have to release that information or confirm or deny whether you have it. Just a bit of an insight into that. So that's what FOIA is. It's subject to a bunch of exclusions that are all set, and there's other rules and regulations around it. But in a sort of nutshell, that's what that is.
And it was part of the Labour, New Labour's kind of transparency. I think John Major before that was all these proposals for making government more transparent. I remember it quite distinctly. And then the New Labour was saying, we're going to have this freedom of information legislation, public authority is going to be more transparent, this information is going to be available to the public. So the Act was passed in 2000, wasn't it? But there was an 8-year leading period for organisations to get up to speed with it.
Yeah, they signed it all off and then they realised it was far too broad. They were going to be far too accountable, I think, for the decisions that they made. And they just sort of put more and more exclusions in and tightened the framework around what that looked like. So things like the 18 hours. Anything over 18 hours of gathering that data, you can apply the overtime exclusion.
Yeah. But in his memoirs, in his biography, Tony Blair said, "Freedom of information, three harmless words. I look at those words as I write them and feel like shaking my head till it drops off my shoulders. You idiot. You naive, foolish, irresponsible nincompoop."
Yeah.
So in retrospect, it's like, oh, God, what did I do that for?
Yeah, it's been said to be one of the worst decisions he ever made, is how he's reported it. And essentially because I think a lot of people in local government and central government feel like it's misused. So it's been, the purpose was to be transparent with the public, but it's actually been used by a lot of journalists to get a lot of information rather than just coming for general questions. And it means that they have to respond within a certain time frame. So it's made journalists' lives a lot easier, but it's made public authorities' lives a lot harder.
Yeah, I've been corrected. I told you everyone knows more about this stuff than we do. I've been corrected on the lead-in time, five years.
5 years.
And so it only covers public authorities, doesn't it? So a lot of our like social housing clients, our commercial clients, they're not necessarily covered by FOIA, but sometimes they are if they're doing holding data for the phrase is holding, isn't it, rather than processing. So it's just, again, slightly different terminology.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of, say, the local authorities now particularly they've branched out because local authorities, if none of you know, aren't able to make their own money. So they have companies called trading companies, essentially, that fall underneath them. They're also caught by FOIA. So while they are a separate body, they are funded by the local authority they sit with. So they're also caught by it.
Yeah. And of course, I think probably everyone knows that in the back of the Freedom of Information Act, there is a list of public authorities. And that's where the definition of public authority comes from in the GDPR, UK GDPR.
Yeah. Some people confuse it with SAR, because SAR is obviously everyone's caught by it. So they confuse the two. But yeah, FOIA, you have to be listed to be able to be caught by it.
So a comment that Maria is making is that, SAR requests are becoming so complex, and I've never worked, well, I've worked in public authorities, but not for a long time, before this came into effect. I worked at Teesside Training Enterprise Council many years ago, but that was back in the 90s. But what is so complex about them? Why are they so hard to answer? Is it just that the requests are so broad, or is the information so hard to find? What's again, everyone's experience, but yours to start with, Laura, what makes them complex?
You've got different types. So you've got your general requests for information. Those can be complex in their own right. So you can have commercially sensitive information connected to it. You can also get things like all correspondence requests. So very similar to SARS, you have to do full interrogations of every system and find every email that may be connected. So those can be quite complex because they can be quite resource intensive. It's also complex going through all the exclusions and knowing what you can and cannot apply and where decision notices have been issued. And going through all of those. So a lot of it's held by teams like governance teams who aren't necessarily legally qualified. So they're just trying to go through as best they can and apply the exclusions.
Yeah. So it's not so much that the requests are complex. I mean, I've looked at some and it's like, can you give me the results of the study of bats for this new site that Lidl wants to develop? and that in itself, oh, crikey, where's that information? But it's the actual way you've got to approach the complexity of the depth of the information, and potentially it's in multiple systems, that what makes it complex.
Yeah, that can be complicated. It's also complicated once that information gets published. It's what's the knock-on impact of that? Is there going to be a commercial impact? If it's a contentious, so bats in an attic situation, are there any neighbours connected to that that are going to kick off because their report's been published? Has something gone wrong in the background that you're not necessarily going to be keen to have published? So there can be different complexities around all of it. The level of aggression when you refuse to provide an exemption.
Yeah,
get very jumpy.
Anecdotally, I thought that most requests came in from journalists. I wouldn't have thought journalists would get aggressive if you told them that you weren't going to respond, or you.
Journalists can, but not necessarily. It tends to be more if you're a local authority where you've got very jumpy residents. You can have complexities within the organisation itself. So some teams will just refuse to deal with them. They just won't engage. And that creates some blocks for you.
So if we should be talking about frogs then rather than bats, if you've got jumpy residents.
Yes, definitely frogs.
I see. And I mean, but local authorities don't have any, or do they have any more sophisticated systems than everybody else uses? I mean, how easy is it to find this information? Have they got specialist tools? Have they got specialist databases? Have they got, you know, specialist suppliers that help them to find information? Or is it just that they're up against it like the rest of us when it comes to SARS?
I think they're up against it. I think more so budget cuts essentially over the years have created a bit of a hybrid situation in local authorities, particularly ones that are smaller and have more constricted budgets. So you'll have a lot of paperwork that's around the building that's being stored. You do have things like purview that will be used, but that isn't necessarily going to catch all of the paperwork which can be around.
Yeah. Well, what's the, Janice has mentioned about a category E, I suppose it is, Cat E fine for staff who refuse. Who levies that fine? What's that all about, the fines?
I've never dealt with it. I wrote it into the disciplinary policy that everyone had to deal with it or we would fire them. So,
oh, right, okay.
Right, I front-ended that.
Right, okay. Bet you were popular. That's where all that level of aggression comes from.
I didn't mess around. When I was responsible for it, I didn't mess around.
Hi, Phil. Jan here. I put the comment in about the category E fine. It's the ICO that would actually levy that fine.
Oh, would they, right, on the individual member of staff?
Aye. It's an individual. Right. It's not an organisation thing. And we have it in very small text in the bottom of all our first requests out to departments that actually has that on it, that it can be a category E fine. It's about 5k the last time I actually checked.
Really?
It's never been used as far as I can tell, or maybe once, but we've never had to actually sort of go there with it.
Well, the stakes are really high then. I mean, the exemptions can be quite complicated, can't they?
Oh, yeah. They can.
As Laura said, you've got some departments that just go, absolutely no, we're not dealing with this, we're refusing to do it. And it's a case of we've got the emails back from them. And when we have to actually issue a sort of notice out to the applicant saying, we're really sorry, but we have been unable to get this information, they complain to the ICO. Then the ICO actually gets all of our backup material about things.
Right.
That's another clever way around it.
And that's not just a Scottish FOIA thing, is it? Is that also in the...
No. I mean, look, okay, Scottish accent, Greenock in the background behind me. I actually work at Kingston Hospital.
Oh, right. So, okay. Apologies for making that assumption. That's very racist of me, actually, wasn't it? Yeah, right. Okay, great. So you're down in London, are you then? You're at the... Is it Kingston?
Kingston, yes.
Pont Thames or Pont Hull?
Kingston upon Thames, on Thames. Okay. Have been to Hull as one of the scenic tours of the industrial parks of England, looking for a scanning bureau for our health records.
Right.
So have gone up that far, but no. Head of Information Governance, originally brought in back in 2005, so I have been around that long. First love was actually data protection. Back when that was actually first, the original 84 Act, I did one of the very first registrations for that. Not the ticky box exercise. This is a case of write an essay.
Exactly. That's how it should be, though, isn't it? Yeah. I liked that process. I mean, it's a right pain in the neck to do, filling all those forms. But, you know, it's like the rope, it forced you to get a handle on what you were doing.
Yeah. But no, I've been doing sort of FOI here from about, I think it was actually 5 months in when FOI actually got fully enacted. And of course, it's totally retrospective as well. So there isn't actually any backstop on it, that you can only be from 2000 onwards. You got the whole thing.
So if you were in for the beginning, because I went to see a district council a few months ago, just before Christmas, to ask them about how they basically dealt with the foyer, because we were trying to help our housing clients with their preparations for this new STAIRS scheme, which is the right of access to information. And basically this person at district council said, well, governments weren't involved, the legal team did it, we think they did a superficial overview of it, we don't think it's been done properly, but that's how it is. What was the kind of the process like? Were you integrally involved in it, or did you inherit a finished job?
Before I actually started here, we had a Freedom of Information working group that I actually went through. They decided things like, you know, for the naming of staff, it was band 6 and above. It's now band 8A and above. Sorry, Health Service has this agenda for change banding system. So band 6 is your average ward sister. Band 8 is usually a matron or senior admin type bods for it. So they'd actually gone through the thing. I'd first discovered it. I was at a data protection conference, and part of that they had a panel first, the very first plenary session. I was on that, and they were talking about freedom of information. I think, thank God I'm not in a public authority. And then I went to work for one. So yes, dealing with FOI and the whole thing about the interview process, I first of all actually dropped off all of the ICO guidance. Started reading that and thinking, what the heck is going on here? Had to buy a copy of the Act, read that, then the guidance actually made sense for it. But each case taken on a case-by-case basis. I mean, we know when I came here, I thought, right, it's going to be patients that are going to be asking us FOI inquiries. It's definitely going to be patients. First year, two patients. And that's about it. I mean, some of the weird and wackies we've had, I mean, you know, first year, have we had any ghost hauntings or other paranormal activity in the trust in a 5-year period? If so, what did we do about it? And more importantly, how much did it cost? So you talk to your risk management people, have there been any incidents logged of any of this stuff? And, you know, this one has actually cropped up again last year, and our risk people went, are you having a laugh? They went, no. Last time we did it, our lead chaplain, Father Grant, the answer was yes. He performed a blessing in the area, therefore it was free of charge. So we've got all of that kind of stuff. We've got inquiries where, you know, one from a firm of solicitors that was acting on behalf of a charity, 5 pages worth of verbiage in this. And it came down, we had to read it about 5 times to actually be absolutely sure, but it came down to one sentence somewhere buried in the middle was the actual request for information. We think they were getting paid by the word for this. And then you get the ones where you have got, literally it comes in as thousands of requests in one particular FOI.
Yeah.
And it's a case of, yes, hello, Section 12, appropriate limit. For us, sort of not central government boards, we have 18 hours. So it's either £450 or 18 hours at £25 an hour. If you're central government, sorry, mates, but yours is actually £600 at £25 an hour to do
18
it. So,
hours, 18 hours isn't an awful lot of time, is it?
No. And when you actually start adding it up, I mean, one of the worst ones we had, it was this one. It was all about equality and diversity. It was humongous. It was huge. And our director of personnel at the time went, actually, I'm very interested in that. Can we just go and do that? It's a case of, no, it's a Section 12 waiting to happen. But we did it.
Yeah.
You know, we smelled sweetly and we did it.
Now, I met Laura and she rang me up this morning to say what we're doing on this podcast, you know, in normal, well-organized preparation. And I said, I've got no idea, Laura. But anyway, we got chatting about it for you. And we kind of said, I said to Laura, well, is it the case that this is an obligation to help people format their requests if they are, I'm not going to phrase this properly, but it's an obligation that they're on a public authority to help people formulate their request. So if a request comes in and it's going to be like 25 hours or 30 hours of work, is there a positive obligation to say to them, well, if you rephrase it like this, then we'll deal with it, but otherwise we're going to kick it out?
Yeah, you have to ask them to refine. Well, you have to give them the opportunity to refine their request.
Right.
They quite often won't.
Right. Okay. Well, that's probably easier into that way.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
But you can evidence that you've tried.
Yeah. That's part of the battle into all this stuff. Yeah. That's really good. But Bethan's point is valid, perfectly valid, isn't it? You know, it's been some very good investigative journalism that has rooted out, you know, issues that the public should be aware of. I mean, again, I remember when I studied, I haven't looked at Freedom of Information for, I'd have thought, 6 years. That's when I was doing my master's degree. There was a module on FOIA. I remember reading all about the Black Spider memos and all that type of stuff. But there's quite a lot of controversy, isn't there, about the application to the Crown and also other things. What are the key points, really, that you think are the controversial aspects? But I mean, what Beth is saying is spot on. You know, the Act has been used to flush out things that the public should be aware of.
I think the controversial areas are for different sectors. Say for me, a district, it was about the community around you, and it was about what they found contentious at that time, and that was always going to give you the biggest issue. I think in healthcare, it would be your scandals. So it would be anything around any scandals that are taking place. The minute anything hits the press, you're going to get a FOIA about it from different people. You can guarantee it.
But you often see, I mean, Ashton's point again is a good point, isn't it? You often see these reports you get, you know, the newspapers and saying, you know, following a freedom of information request, you know, we asked all the police authorities in the UK this same question. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting though that sometimes you read these reports as well, you know, 50% replied and 50% didn't. You know, how does that work if everyone's in the same, you know, position? I suppose maybe some would say it's going to take us longer to deal with that, I guess.
Some just don't respond. So with journalists or with academia, so if people have submitted requests as part of a PhD project, some people just won't respond. And journalists and PhD students won't necessarily follow up. They won't necessarily complain. So some people just never respond. So you'll only ever get part of the picture.
Yeah, this one question is Lindsay's in the chat is interesting. Isn't it? So why would this be a freedom of information request? An early request, an applicant, could they change their species from human to dragon? It seems, seems like it's the misuse of the Freedom of Information Act to me. There must be another law that they could raise that with.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I think I saw something in the chat about aliens as well.
Right. Okay, maybe they think there's a comment about us, maybe. I don't know.
Has anyone else got any odd FOIAs they've received? So we've had ghosts. Has anyone got anything
great
that
Janet's
can beat ghosts?
On. I didn't. We didn't mean to move off without saying thank you, Janice, but thank you for coming on.
Yeah, I'm quite excited now about people's... I think someone has. I think someone can beat ghosts.
But annoying, Phil, but I heard that someone got one about how many taps they had.
What taps? What, as in
how many taps? Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Was it procurement based by any chance?
Yeah, it was quite interesting because you had to look at building plans, and there was a kind of a trick of disproportionate, because if you wanted to run around a site that's almost 200 years old and discover how many taps, because if you've missed one, you're technically giving in inaccurate information. And it's probably what I can't say too much about, but someone asked if there was like a museum dedicated to certain things. Can't say what they are, but you can imagine with surgeries and other things like that, there's someone out there who's looking to attend these museums. Imagine getting requests like that. You imagine there should be a help desk in the hospital where they just answer questions, because the person wanted to not be identified, so they just wanted to visit this museum, and I'll let you guess what it was. But yeah, I think we've had that, and I had one environmental quest that was 8 pages long, and it had a question on every line. And they said it was for the dissertation in 2 weeks, and it took us 3 months to respond because it was 90% of it was on Google, apparently. But you wouldn't know by reading it. It was like, could you also put all that information in a graph exactly like this?
Right.
Okay. Some of the questions.
Can you also write my dissertation for me? Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly that. You know, yeah. I tried to hint that. I had a phone call with a person, and I said, she said, even my professor said it was a bit rude to ask that much. I thought that's probably the red flag, but it's not. You got some really interesting ones there. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, the taps are good, because I'd clean forgotten actually that we probably should talk about. You know, those who are in the know will know that often the Freedom of Information Act is used for suppliers to gain information about tendering cycles and you know, commercial information and things of that nature. Again, is that a good use of public resources? You know, to respond to those types of requests. Should that information be pushed out there anyway?
No, a contract register will help you with a lot of those questions, because all of the basic information is there. So anyone that's got a contract register, that's where I would point them to. Now, we've got lots of really interesting FOIAs coming through in the chat.
I'm trying to read
reason.
The chat here. Alien encounters. There's all sorts of very interesting or interesting things. Now, people have mentioned, you know, Section 12, Section 16. Mm-hmm. Do you want to delve into, you know, how the Act is structured and what these things are, or the exemptions? Are we going to get into that level of detail? I'm bearing in mind I've only got 15 minutes. I can't believe how the time has flown. But anyway,
I told you the FOIA one would go really fast. Yeah, there's a number of exemptions. There's a handful, really, that they're all relevant to different types in different ways. So you've got your absolute and your qualified. So absolute exemptions are just solid. You just send them, you apply it, you're fine. Qualified, you have to apply the public interest test. So there's a number. So you've got your vexatious, you've got your repetitious, not necessarily in the exclusions, but those are part of it. You've got your cost, which we touched on earlier. So anything over, depending, but for local authorities, 18 hours. Anything which is intended for future publication, so your section 22. So if you intend to publish it within a reasonable time frame, you can tell them that and point them to where it could be. So if you've got like an FAQ page like I had, and you knew it was going to be linked to there. What I did was have a, I used the publication scheme as a contents page for all of those FOI FAQs, essentially. So you just pointed in that direction, and a couple of months later, that information would appear.
Yeah.
And then you've got your environmental information. So there's a very similar legislation to FOIA.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then if it's personal data, either of the requester or someone else, so your section 40.
Yeah, but the environmental information regulations, again, they're slightly odd in a way, because they are more likely to catch more kind of non-public authorities, aren't they? So water companies, utility companies who are companies, but you know, if they're doing what they're doing, and some of our social housing providers as well, if they're doing something which has got an impact on the environment, which is caught by the environmental information regulations, they're caught by the EIR, aren't they?
Yeah, there are some teams that may be in a local authority, depending on the circumstances, so planning and environmental health. Two key ones that it may be an EIR rather than an FOI.
I was just going to say that David's saying about decision notice. Again, I'd kind of such a lot to talk about on this subject, didn't there? I thought, I wonder how many, because the IC seems to do absolutely gazillions of decision notices, or they actually seem to have slowed down a bit now, but at one point it seemed to be churning out tons of decision notices, some of which were interestingly quite contradictory. Compared to data protection work, I wonder how, again, I don't know if I've got any experience with this, I wonder how much resource is allocated to FOIA and EIR as opposed to, you know, data protection at the ICO. But they say on their website they've done 13,500 freedom of information and environmental cases since 2005, which is quite a lot.
Yeah, huge amounts.
Yeah. And you've got this 20-day working limit, limit as well, 20 working day limit as well, haven't we, that David's referred to get these things turned around. And if you're getting swamped by them, that's getting quite challenging.
It tends to cause you problems where your internal teams won't give you the information you need. So to get around that, I did a 10-day internal timeframe. So people internally, which adds to the weight of my disciplinary issue. So if people didn't respond to me in 10 working days, it got escalated to their managers, and then it became a further issue. So that sped up the process quite a lot where I was.
Yeah. So Sarah Gallier's, hello Sarah. Sarah's comment about journalists publishing before you've even had a chance to respond.
Yes.
I bet that's really frustrating. You commit all this resource and time, right? We're going to do this, we're going to do a proper job with this. And then you're reading the Guardian or whatever newspaper it is about the story. You think, oh, blimey, you know, do we still have to respond? You know, the story's gone out.
Yeah, and there's that. And there's also the election period. So elections can cause you some spit of heat around this time, particularly because you're in PIRDA. So you've got to be really careful about what you're publishing during the PIRDA period.
Yeah, we need to talk about the election, don't we? Data protection, personal data in the election, which I think maybe we have to do next week or the week after, before the election. But again, the ICO has put some guidance out, haven't they, about this?
They have. Yeah, we've still got a few weeks to go, so we can do some proper time on that.
Yeah, wild boars as pets sounds very, very dangerous. Astra's mentioned about wild boars as pets.
Yeah, we actually had that at the local authority I was at. Right. Astra's never forgotten it.
Right. There's some very interesting things here. Dog droppings. How many? That's bizarre. Refuses vexatious.
Perhaps we should do this as a blog. We should get people's weirdest and wonderfulest FOIAs and do like a little blog article on it. If anyone wants to submit them to me, just we can do that and publish you.
Now, you wanted to talk about vexatious, didn't you, about the notion of vexatiousness? And again, this is what Lindsay's highlighted, that it was refused as a vexatious request. I don't know if this is serious or whether it's or not, but I'm assuming it is serious that this request did come in and it was like, no, we're not going to deal with that. But the notion of vexatious is interesting. Is there any thoughts on that?
It
easy
is.
To apply?
It's not easy to apply. Yeah. The odds of you getting a vexatious approved by the ICO and upheld that you're right, pretty slim. So we've, and I'm Colin and Sally, who used to work with me, are on this, and they'll probably attest to if they're confident enough to come on camera. We had some particular residents who were very vexatious. And if you said the word vexatious, it would trigger a number of people in the organisation to go, I know who you're talking about.
Right.
But they still didn't quite meet that test for vexatious. Right. So we still wouldn't have had that upheld. So we still had to go through the motions of responding to those people. So vexatious is a really good concept. It's amazing. But it's kind of like a treat that you just can't quite get to.
Yeah, it's one of those grabby machines you get at the fairs. Yeah, you're trying to get a minion out. And yeah, Michael's got his hand up, so I think we should go to Michael. But I think we should come back to vexatious, because I think it's...
We could do a whole session on it. I think people could talk about it for hours.
Yeah, Michael, can you just butt in, Michael? We don't mind.
Oh, sorry. But no, it's vexatious. I think you're right. Like the ICO, sometimes it will tell you, or they will say it looks like it is, and then when you mark it, then the person will contest it, and then they'll say, why did you mark it as vexatious? We don't think it's vexatious. So
here's your emails.
yeah, we had a very trick, I can't say too much, but there was a one where the person was arguing about a wall, and they were so angry, and they kept going back and forth. They did SARs, FOIs, everything else, and then we got advice, and then it actually led to the ICO say, that looks like a vexatious request. Then they used it, and then they said later to the person who contested it, that actually it isn't vexatious.
Yeah.
Could you supply the information immediately? And it was like, oh my God, let's catch up and give them all the data from the last request as well. So I think it took them probably 40 hours to do that in the end.
Wow, right.
And I'm not sure that... I think they duplicated it because they didn't have enough resources, but it was quite challenging. So I think you're right. I think you have to try and get your IG experts, or just try and get some advice first and then go to the ICO, because the ICO will say, well, we didn't have all the information at the time, or we didn't have it all written down. We had 5 minutes to discuss it, so we came to a conclusion based on what we heard. And then you kind of stuck there.
So
the ICO is very similar across data protection, FOIA, SARs, across all of it. It's very, very similar in the fact that you never know what you're going to get. So the case handler, everything you've got is very dependent on the case handler you've got. So decisions can change.
I was just on that. You never know what you're going to get. I was watching Forrest Gump a few weeks ago, and he goes, life's like a box of chocolates. You never know. I was going to get a T-shirt made of that. Data protection is like a box of chocolates. But anyway, moving on. Thank you, Michael, for that. Now, Toby's question is really interesting. That's triggered a thought in my mind. So he said, what about requests from outside the UK? And Lawrence is saying, yeah, they are equally valid. But why is it like such an effort to amend and water down data protection legislation by this government? You know, it's obviously fallen off the tracks now because of the election. But why not amending FOIA, you know, if it's bogging down local authorities and is too broadly conceived because it's not restricted to UK citizens or certain groups of UK, why not try and repeal that? Amend that. I don't know if there has been efforts to do it, but Lawrence got his hand up.
A couple of reasons. First is that it's basic customer service. So while people might say they're inundated with FOIs, it's just an extension of customer service. You're getting calls all the time, and services are dealing with people all the time. Secondly, if you go back to pre-FOI, that world was really dark. The council or the organization say, nope, you're not getting it. Tough. Go away. And that's it. You wouldn't get anything. They could just say, saw it off. I mean, I talked to the old school people back in the day, and they're like, oh, God, I can't believe we have this. Why do we have this? Back in the day, we could just tell them to saw it off, and they'd never have to get the information. You're like, wow. Third, the political parties all use it. They all see the benefit from it. So when they're in power, they don't. But when they're out of power, they see the benefits. You see this from the political parties across the spectrum using FOI. As soon as they're out of power, boom, the FOIs blow up. I'm not saying everybody benefits from it.
Yeah.
And lastly, the transparency helps. It gives discipline to organizations, sort of helps them know what they have. So there is a benefit to the organization, whether they know it or not. Because when you're being asked this stuff, it gives you a sense of what's going on in your own organization. So those are probably some of the reasons why would never get fully repealed. It will get modified on the edges, like fixatious and fees limits and those things. But I would doubt that the overall culture would do it.
Yeah.
But, and then probably lastly is a lot of the stuff that goes out through FY is usually, if it's scandalous, there's been a mistake along the way. Because like that thing that happened in Northern Ireland, if you had a decent quality control along the way, somebody would have said, hold on, we're giving the full list. Why are we giving the full list?
Yeah.
Versus, because usually because it's been chewed up so much, it's rarely the silver bullet that somebody goes, aha, through FY, I found out this really secret thing. Usually where you see that, you want to find that example, you find people finding that in the archives. Because that's when somebody's disclosed something that's hidden away. They don't realize it should have been withheld, or somebody might have cleaned it up. Like you had with the ICUS, the child sexual abuse things, where they were pulling stuff out of documents from 30, 40 years ago. But then if you want to take that even deeper and a bit darker, you have to wonder how much is scrubbed before it ever gets to the archives.
I think I'm going to come to Tobias. I think I remember reading somewhere that the Swedish had decades ago. And all that happened was that the parliament stopped writing things down. Things were still verbally. But I don't know whether that's true or hearsay. But this police service in Northern Ireland breach was not a fault of FOIA. It's a fault of, as Lawrence quite rightly says, the fault of a floppy process. I'm going to come to Toby in a second. But one of the things I did find at Information Governance show this week was a company that say that when they do encryption of data, it's not really so much encryption, it's hashed, but they hash the personal data in such a way that it, the names and addresses, it looks like legitimate data, but it's not, it's all been changed. And I don't know how it works. The guys on the stand didn't know how it works. So I said, well, so that means that if somebody produced a report and it went through this hashing algorithm and a hacker got hold of it, they would assume that it was valid data, but it's actually effectively pseudonymized data. He said, yeah. So I've got that as a thing to follow because that sounded quite interesting. Toby, sorry, you had your hand up for a while.
I just want to make a couple of quick points around the What Do They Know website. I took issue with them and I contacted them recently, I think it was back end of last year, because now I'm sure you know you can generate massive, what I call scattergun FOIs to hundreds, if not thousands, of local authorities and schools and all sorts very easily, very quickly. And it's in twice in quick succession, the users had generated hundreds of these requests, but they'd immediately got banned by the platform, and they'd been banned because they broke the rules of anti-spamming. But my issue with them is, What Do They Know did not withdraw those hundreds of requests, and they didn't inform any of the local authorities or the people who'd received them that the user had immediately been banned for spamming. And I took issue with this because, from my point of view, if they've broken the rules of the platform, they should delete or remove those FOIs. But the FOIs stood, even though they'd banned the user. What were your any comments or views on that? They were saying they were still valid FOIs even though they'd banned the user.
If you want my sort of honest opinion, I think my uncensored honest opinion is it's probably one of my least favourite websites. Not just because of the way I like the concept that you can get in touch with multiple organisations at the same time and just submit the same request across. I think that's great. But yeah, as Michael said, it's manned by volunteers who don't necessarily know what they're doing, or they're under-resourced to be able to do it effectively. So it's not just the fact that they don't remove people. I've never found real policies or procedures around their criteria and how they would handle that. And there's a lot of stuff that just gets left hanging on there that is unresponded to, that they don't follow up with. So it just becomes, it's a great tool, I think, for sending the information out. But I think the after effect of that, I think, lacks.
Yeah. So Toby's question about, well, surely those requests aren't valid if the user's being banned from the platform.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not sure the law accommodates that, does it? It's basically, you know, if it allows journalists from outside of the UK to raise valid requests, then the fact you've been banned from a platform is not relevant, is it?
FOIA with you stands, but what I would say is any of those requests that come through, if they're not likely to follow up the ICO and you have ignored it, there is very nominal consequence of that. So while I don't recommend you ever do that, If your priorities get shifted to other things, then I think that's a workaround.
Yeah. Lawrence makes a fantastic point in the chat. I'm completely out to sea with the chat at 1313, which is that each question is a request. So again, if you have a letter with 10 questions in it, that's 10 requests. So that 18 hours is actually 180 hours. So, you know, you can see how potentially it all gets a little bit out of hand because all these requests need, I mean, they might be very, very similar and all, you know, subject to the same research. Therefore, your time limit then gets padded out, doesn't it? Just trying to scroll through the, there's lots of very interesting stuff in the chat here. Exorcisms, that seems quite a popular one. Bike racks, very popular.
No, you can't, just for... if you are on the What Do They Know website, for anyone who doesn't know what that is, it's just it's that generic website, also known as WDKK. They have their own email. So if they've gone off the platform, you can't respond to them. You just have to log it as removed from platform in your own internal systems, whether you use a spreadsheet or other.
Right. I was just having a look at this one. I'm out of time now. Matthew's put in the ICO recently returned one of their own FOIAs, which they refused as vexatious. So I'd be quite interested to read that decision though, because it's 10 pages long. So I'm not going to be able to do it in the next 2 minutes. I can't believe it's 2 minutes. I'm sorry, I haven't got through most of this chat. There's lots and lots of good stuff going on here. So freedom of expression is a popular topic, and I think we probably ought to give it much. We've only just talked about, you know, around it, haven't we? About it, haven't really gotten into any detail.
There's so much to it.
We probably, but again, I don't know if what people want us to talk about in terms of the FOIA, but we're happy to kind of tailor it. I think if so, let's have a real chat about, you know, some aspects of it or some of the exemptions or whatever it is. Then, you know, we're absolutely up for tailoring a session that is.
Also happy to do one of those sessions where we talk about the weird and wonderful FOIAs. If you need a therapy session on it, just so you can vent for anyone impacted by it.
Yeah. It's that spa, isn't it?
You know, counselling hour.
Back to that image that Miles flashed up earlier.
Yeah, I think we're down for the therapy session.
Yeah. Now, I'm afraid we've theoretically run out of time, but we could talk all afternoon, Laura, about this. And I'm sure everyone's got lots of different things to do. But, you know, this is one of the beauties of doing the podcast. It, when we got great engagement with people, it's just really fun to do. So we've run out of time, really. But we need to schedule another FOIA. But again, seriously, if people want us to focus on certain things, you know, someone's saying a section 77s, then, you know, let's put another
time together. Yeah,
exactly, about it. Yeah. Now, what have you got on this week then? Have you got next week, have you got anything exciting going on?
I don't think so. I think we've got a lot of phishing attacks going on at the minute, so I'm getting involved in lots of those, not with us, with clients, particularly schools.
Yeah, you're getting absolutely bombarded with subject attack requests, aren't you? Not again, not us, but
I don't know whether people are just going home and drinking wine in the garden and just want to know everything that's been said about them, but it seems to be like the Sarageddon, as we're calling it at the minute.
We've got 50 SARs or something.
Yeah, we have. Yeah, it's great. And transcripts as well. We do a lot of transcriptions for people.
Right.
So we're taking calls and either listening to see if it's been passed on internally, where you've talked about the data subject while you're passing the call, and just making sure they can't be heard.
Yeah.
Or full transcripts. So yeah, it's just been crazy.
All right, madness. So we've got a new start. We've got a very exciting, I think next week, I think we've got a new, so we'll have to get her on the podcast. Suzanne. Yeah, she spent 5 years at the Danish ICO equivalent, the Danish regulator, in a couple of departments. So I'm really, really, I think she's going to be a fantastic colleague. She's joining us on the 15th, I think. So we'll have to get on the podcast. I think she'll have some very, very good points of view and insights.
Definitely. And we're interviewing as well for 2 more trainee positions as well this week.
Oh, excellent.
So those are ongoing. What about you? Good. Anything exciting?
Not
getting
really
lost in London again, or are you just...
No, I don't know what I'll be doing next week. I've got a couple of meetings, and I've got in my diary like a year-to-date review of the business next Thursday.
Oh, yeah, we've got that Thursday, haven't we? I'll do that presentation for you.
So I have to do a bit of planning around that and get on top of what we've been up to and where we're going with things. So, yeah, busy. I need to get back on with some data-wise stuff. Got a meeting with a massive international drinks company in Jamaica about their compliance program in Jamaica. I'm still doing a lot of work with Jamaica. In fact, one of the reasons I was in London is I was meeting one of my clients who's flown in from Jamaica for some meetings. I said I'd go down and have lunch with him. But then the tubes were up the spout, so we didn't end up having lunch. Just had a pint instead. So busy, busy. Anyway, listen, I'm afraid though that we've run out of time. Thank you very much, Laura, for giving up your time to talk to us about it. And thank you everybody who's on for giving up their time to come and, you know, make the podcast work. You know, it's great to get your opinions and to get your contributions. So without further ado, have a fantastic weekend. And hopefully next week is just going to be like a GDPR radio. So a bit more kind of chat and news and bits and pieces, gossip. So in the meantime, have a great weekend and we hope to see you next Friday.
Yeah, see you all soon. Have good weekends.